Ready? No problem. All right, thank you for your patience. We will go ahead and get Planning Commission started tonight. Welcome, we're glad you're here. Thank you for being here. Thank you, staff, for getting everything up and running as far as the electronics go. We will move into agenda item number two, public comments that are not pertaining to agenda item. Any comments at this point?
Sure.
All right, if you can state your name. All right.
I attended the last...
If you could just state your name in the microphone for our minutes.
Is this better? Okay. So I'm Mont Mickelson. I'm a resident of the city and also a landlord. I attended the last Planning Commission meeting, and during that it seemed to me that it was an implicit direction towards justifying an approval short-term apartment rentals. The motivation behind that continues to escape me. Certainly the intent would not be to provide more affordable housing, because changing the code would result in the reduction of the number of affordable apartments and in the number of prospective affordable apartments. We will be better off by leaving short-term rentals to the Motel 6 or the Marriott hotels. The constant turnover in short-term rentals occupied by transient renters who we do not know and who we will never know, since they move out too quickly and for whom no criminal history report is checked, jeopardizes the safety of children who are constantly walking to and from school in a dedicated pathway for that purpose. Is there some advantage to our established neighborhoods to validate short-term rentals? Is it possible to anticipate all of the unintended consequences of this proposed code change? After our neighborhoods are degraded by short-term rentals, is it possible to put the horse back in the stable by reversing the code change? Perhaps we should leave short-term rentals to companies who are already licensed to provide those services. Perhaps we should concentrate on providing more affordable housing to those who live in our community, rather than shifting our emphasis to providing short-term housing to those who have no attachments to our community. Perhaps the consideration of a code change authorizing short-term rentals should be dismissed altogether. I have other considerations that I've put in the letter before you. I encourage you to take time to read them and address them perhaps at a later date or maybe tonight. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Mr. Mickelson. We appreciate you and bringing up the points and interest in making sure that we get this right as we try and draft up this part of the code. Thank you for being here. All right, we will move to agenda item number three, consideration of a plat amendment to combine lots 1511 at Eaglewood Estates Phase 15. We'll have Mackenzie and then we'll do the public hearing.
Oh, perfect. I forgot this one was a public hearing. I just got very confused. I mean, so many people come out for them. All righty, guys. So the property is 1030 South Parkway Drive. Sherry, would you mind clicking over for me? This property and the neighboring properties purchased some land adjacent to Tunnel Springs Park from the city around 2020, give or take, on each lot. And when that happened, we didn't require them to formally combine the parcels, which some might argue was a mistake. So now this property owner is wanting to build a detached garage on the back half of their newly acquired property. And in order to do that, we have to combine the existing lot with the parcel that they purchased and vacate the existing rear yard public utility easement. We have done other public utility easement releases along this stretch, and no utility companies have had any issues. Our city engineer has reviewed this in depth and has determined that we won't need this PUE because the park is adjacent to us and that's our property anyways. So if we needed to use it, we could use our property. We have received letters granting the release of the public utility easement from Comcast, Rocky Mountain Power, and South Davis Sewer. We do water. And just because we don't have one from like the gas company or anything like that doesn't mean that it cannot be vacated through this. A silence means they're fine with it, is kind of the way the state code rolls with it. And yeah, there's a few engineering red lines. There's actually quite a few, and they were sending me a revision, but they all have to do with just the general signature blocks and having the plat laid out so that the recorder's office will accept it. And therefore, the DRC is recommending approval of this plat amendment with one condition, that they correct the engineering red lines. I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Any questions?
That portion just to the south of the property, that's public right away too, right? Isn't there a that the trail? Isn't that a
public to the south of the property?
Right?
Yeah, that's the Tunnel Springs Park. So that's owned by the city. And then on the east side of the property, there is a right-of-way along the sidewalk, which is also trail easement. So, and we'll have them extend that all the way down. If you see that dotted line, we'll have them extend it all the way down to the new property line.
So this is just one lot that had this. Is this the first of many of these we're going to get? Or are all the other owners going to have to request the same
potentially
combination?
It depends what they want to build. The ones next door did a sports court, and so they were able just to go in and do flat work and didn't necessarily have to combine these and vacate an easement, because you can put flat work in an easement. Gotcha. If they want to put a structure or anything like that, then we need to vacate easement properly and combine the parcels. I think the neighbors so far have just gone to the county and for taxing purposes combined it into one parcel number and improved that area with that information.
Commissioner Marsh, do you know what the original intent of the easement was? Like why this was originally created like this?
The standard of subdivision development in the area of every other side yard having an easement in every rear yard. So that would be my analysis. Yeah, just in case. You never know. So they're rarely used, but nice to have when we need them.
Okay, I will open the public hearing. If there's a comment.
D. Lawless, it's long. I think Bill asked that. Would you go back to the previous slide? I had a question and I looked at this. Can you go back to the previous one?
Oh, excuse me, sorry.
Oh. Oh, that one. If you look at the properties to the west, those were the ones that I think Kent McKenzie just talked about. One of them looks like it has a pickleball court on it, and the other one has a swimming pool. Are they part of the same previous purchase of that? And so those properties, they just decided, I don't care about where the white line is. Is there still an easement that where that white line is?
The easement's on the other side of the white line for the pool. You got to remember,
well, the pool, this is, the white line goes right through the pool.
But this is Davis County parcel data that we overlay into our Google Earth, and so it never aligns perfectly. So the pool is actually on the other side of the easement. But I know this is the Burkhart residents, I believe their names are, and this was before the state amended the code regarding how we vacate easements and everything like that. And so we were able, I think, to do a lot line adjustment, or we even just did letters of release, if I recall correctly. And so they were required as part of this to get letters from every single agency before we did a permit. So things changed a little bit since 2020 when this all occurred, but biggest point, it's on the other side where there isn't an easement.
So the two properties on that left side up there, Are those two separate properties? One with the tennis or the pickleball courts or whatever, and one that's the swimming pool? Are they the same property?
They're the same property, same property.
So the white line down the middle of it
should just go away.
Should just go away.
Right, but okay. Without doing a formal plat amendment like this.
Yeah, I didn't know if Bill would ask the same question or not. So, but I looked at it and I thought, are we going to, you know, before when you do some things, I said, you ought to just contact everybody and get it done all at once.
Yep.
But you said you couldn't do that. And so I just wonder if they're going to come back and say, oh, we need to take off those lines if they're really not there.
Yeah, we advised them at the time of the purchase to come in and do it, and no one really did. I think going forward, if we ever do a transaction like this, I'm going to strongly encourage staff to require it as part of the transaction.
It's actually in the new rules.
Oh, it's in the new subdivision ordinance. So we absolutely, okay. Which rules?
Property disposition rules.
So anyways, we shouldn't have this problem on any other sort of property acquisition moving forward.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Dee. And we will close the public hearing, and then any other discussion or comment by the commission? And if not, we can move to a motion.
Commissioner Holbrook, I move that the Planning Commission recommend to the City Council approval of the plat amendment to combine lot 1511 of Eagle Point Estates, Phase 15 subdivision with parcel number 01-120-0093, and to vacate the rear public utility easement at 1030 South Parkway Drive with the following conditions of completion of the engineering red lines.
Thank you, Commissioner Holbrook, and a second.
I'll second it.
Thank you, Commissioner Ward, and any comment on the motion? All in favor say aye.
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 And any opposed? All right, and it passes. We will move to number five, agenda item five, consideration of amendment modifying title 10. Sherry.
I'm going to try to talk as little as possible because I don't have a lot of voice. So last time we went through all of the proposed changes, and you were going to come back if you had any changes that you needed, that you found in reading them. So I'm not sure if you want to go through that first, but you also asked me to do a little primer for you for short-term rentals. And this is, well, it doesn't work when it's off. So I prepared this little short-term rental history. We adopted this ordinance 2019 in 02-02 in March of 2019. At that time, the legislature had passed ordinances or statutes that said, if we don't adopt standards for short-term rentals, then they're permitted without any standards. So that was the reason why we started, why we went down that road. We were also at the same time doing adopting accessory dwelling unit ordinances. So we did those two concurrently. And basically what we were trying to do with the STUs and the ADUs was to get them on our radar so that we knew where they were, because we didn't know where they were. But we knew lots of people have apartment basements that never got a building permit, and we just didn't know existed. So the problems with that are, A, they're not getting a building permit. We don't know if they're built to code. B, when the census comes and does all of the does your census every 10 years, if we don't have an address for every single unit, then they don't go to look for that unit, and so we're losing some of those counts. And so that was one of the other reasons that we wanted to do it. And the third reason was because we wanted, with the ADUs at least, to give another option for affordable housing, which is one of the strategies in our moderate income housing plan, is to allow people to do ADUs. So we knew there were already short-term rentals. We know Airbnb, we know Vrbo. They're all out there. We can't get rid of them very easily. They're hard to prove. But we felt like at the time that it was better to regulate them, allow them, and regulate them. So the current ordinance requires owner occupancy for a minimum of 6 months of the year. It requires a maximum rental period of 45 days. It requires additional parking based on the size of the unit. It has to have HOA approval if they're in a HOA. They have to provide us with urgent response contacts, so when they file for a business license, we get those contacts of their managers, and if there is a problem with the short-term rental, it was reported to police, we have somebody to contact that can deal with the tenants. It requires property maintenance, has to be kept up. There are rules that are a little more stringent than just your regular single-family dwelling for noise or nuisance control. There's a maximum occupancy for STRs, and the violations escalate based on the number of complaints. So, like, the first one is 500, and then it goes to 1,000 and 1,500. So we already have penalties in place. The proposed amendments allow them in apartments without owner occupancy. We have them in apartments. We know they're there. We've even permitted them as part of the P District over in Village Station in the new buildings. But we don't have any regulations for them per se because they're not owner occupied. But we did allow it as part of that P District. And the next proposal is to have, they allow them to have 50% of those units with a maximum of 10 units. Again, the same max occupancy of 45 days. I was approached by the chief of police today, and he asked me why we had 45 days. He requested that we change that to 30 days so that it's consistent with the state code and the definition between what is a long-term lease and a short-term lease. So that was what he asked me about today. Again, we're getting the urgent contacts for it, and then there's some new penalties for noise. So these penalties are specifically for noise, not just other violations. We still have the same process where they can be fined for every single violation, and that gets their attention when they're going to get fined $500, and the next time they're going to get fined $1,000. But we wanted a better process for revoking the license. We have a process for revoking the license, but what we're trying to say is that if we get 3 complaints in a 12-month period, staff can revoke the license, and then there's an appeal process. So it's a better process to handle administratively rather than have to take them to the city council. And sometimes they're out-of-state owners, or they're not. They're out for 30, 50, you know, part-time, and it's difficult to get them to come in before the hearing officer. So that was why we're putting that in. It's not to make it easier. The other part of the revoking the new proposed code is that if we have a noise complaint and our officers use those urgent contacts, call the manager fails to respond within 2 hours, that's grounds, not on the first time, or not just on the third time, the very first time, if they do not respond and take care of the noise complaint, then it can be revoked. That's a reason to revoke the license as well. And again, then giving a process for actually revoking it by staff. So I just pulled a few of pros and cons for them. First off, the pro is that they're licensed. We know where they are. And then we have their contact information. We're not going to get rid of them. We don't have the staff to do code enforcement at that level where we would. There are so many different code enforcement things that it would be nearly impossible to catch them all the time and shut them down. So it's better to license them, know where they are, and to apply the rules and be able to then have those emergency contacts listed for them. The maintenance on short-term rentals, I think that was a good point that Dee made last time, that with a short-term rental, the owner's representative, the manager, or the cleaning person is coming in every time after they close because they have to clean the property, they have to turn it over for the next rentals, so they tend to stay maintained a little bit better than a long-term rental. Having them licensed, we get to collect the transient room tax, which is only fair that they pay their fair share. And as far as vetting the applicants or the tenants that come and stay, they are vetted through these platforms. For any of you that know, when you stay at Airbnbs, both the host rates the tenants, and the tenants rate the host. And so it's this unique kind of thing where if they were a bad tenant and they were mistreating the property or they caused a nuisance or they got a police report, they're going to, the host is going to report that on the site, and they'll have a harder time renting in the future to any other at other Airbnbs. So it's kind of self-policing as far as that goes. Yeah, we don't know who the tenants are, but if we needed to know who the tenants were, if there was a serious crime that happened, they have the records, they have the credit cards, they have the addresses of everybody who paid for it, so they can find those people. I'm not even concerned about that part. And then the cons, of course, we're losing some dwelling unit inventory. We live in a free market society. I think that's going to happen whether we want it to happen or not. So that's kind of where we're going. And the other cons are that there are some conflicts with neighbors related to parking or trash or noise. And what we can do is address those in a good regulation. We have had very few problems with the Airbnbs that we know about in the city. We do on occasion have complaints. We had one over the weekend. It was a tenant, a renter down in a Foxborough short-term rental, and the owner contacted the police and wanted the police to evict the tenant because they brought a dog and they're not supposed to have dogs. And so there was some question about whether that was something that they can do, because you can do that at a hotel. If the hotel calls the police because somebody is doing something in the room, they can evict them, but that's a little unclear, so we are investigating that. But that's the first complaint we've had probably in 6 or 7 months for a while, and not at the same, they're different ones. The ones that we usually find out about when we get a complaint is because they're not licensed and they don't know the rules and they don't know they're supposed to post what the noise ordinance is and what to do with the trash and where they're supposed to park, because they're not licensed and they didn't have our rules. And we require them in our ordinance to post all of the rules for in a place. Like when you go to Airbnb, there's a book usually on the counter that shows you this, here's the rules, but then they have tabs for local businesses that you can, you know, local restaurants or local attractions. So that's a good thing for us, just to have them known to us. And so I'm not advocating either way. I do think it's better to regulate them than to not regulate them. We've had them in our code for the last 5 years, and we've had very few problems, just a handful.
Thank you. Any comments or questions on that?
Sherry, can we go back two slides to the existing code? And I just wanted to understand again, the 45 days was the current code, and the police chief is recommending 30 days. So
yes.
If I understand it correctly, under state law, short-term rentals have to allow at least 30 days. Is that, no?
No.
It's a maximum of 30 days? So explain that, if you would.
The way it's defined is that anything over 30 days is considered a long-term lease, and so it is not regulated under short-term rentals. So that's where the 30 days comes from. And I think that, as I recall back to 2019, I think that we had this discussion. I think we had it drafted at 30, and everybody's like, well, why do we care if it's a little bit longer than 30 days? What if it's 6 weeks? And that seems like that's how that came to be, that we changed it to 45 days. And he's just asking that it be consistent with state code.
Would anything change on the proposal with the owner occupancy 180 days a year? I'm going to point to my own neighborhood. In a personal example, I called one time just last November and pointed out that they were still watering their lawn at the end of November, December. It was watering the entire sidewalk. It was just sheer ice. So, and to my knowledge, there is not an owner who is there ever.
Is that one that was licensed?
I don't know. It's on Scenic Hills Drive. City, when I talked to whoever I talked to on the phone, they said they'd call them and let them know whoever the contact was. But
it was probably Rocky, and he was our code enforcement officer up until about 3 weeks ago when he resigned. So we're currently hiring a code enforcement officer, and we have a lot of candidates.
But under the modified language, it would still be at least in a single family residence to have 180 days.
Still have to have 180 days occupancy. Okay. The difference between a single family and a an apartment is that all apartments either have an owner-manager or they have a management company that runs those. And so they're the ones actually taking care of a professional management company, or the owner is still attending to these smaller ones.
Commissioner Marsh, is there, so in terms of getting owners licensed, I know we've sort of kind of talked about this point of like carrots and sticks versus, hey, we want owners to come forward, to be licensed, to get in compliance with the ordinance. And I'm aware in some other cities that if a city, you know, if you're running a short-term rental illegally, right? So you're not licensed, you're running it in a zone where it's not allowed, or you're, you know, you were in violation of city code. The penalties for that, I believe in some other cities, are pretty strict, where it's, they require you to forfeit whatever you collected, potentially. Is that something that's been considered in terms of, or, you know, is there like, what are the two sides of this in terms of getting licensed? Where
I don't know how you would get that information for them to forfeit what they've collected. I don't know how that would happen. I can see, like, let's say somebody builds without a building permit.
Mm-hmm.
We can double the building permit fee. So there are those penalties. We haven't ever done that with businesses. And these are businesses. There's no doubt about that. But I think if we were going to do something like that, then it would be any business that operates without a business license. It would be a different, it's in Title 4 or 5. We would say any business found to be operating without a business license, that first year they license them, we could double the fee. Right. Mm. But that would be, we would have to apply that fairly across the board to all businesses, not just this one.
Not just for this particular one that we're trying to get folks licensed for this particular. Okay.
And really the councils and the Planning Commission up to this point has been, their philosophy is that it is better to use a carrot rather than a stick. I mean, we don't want to be a heavy-handed government agency. We want to make things as easy as possible, but we also want people to follow the rules, and we want to give them their rights to do the things they want to do with their property, but we want to give them the parameters that respect the other neighbors and mitigate to the best of our ability any impacts from those businesses or land uses.
Thank you.
Sherry, can we just think a little bit more about the maximum 45 days versus the police chief's recommendation of 30 days? It seems like that merits some serious consideration given the source of the recommendation. But do you see any reason that the city council would? I mean, at the end of the day, this can be a city council decision, yes, not ours. We can recommend whatever we want, but they're going to make the decision as the legislative body. But anyway, thoughts on the 30 days instead?
I really don't have too much heartburn. I've never been a person who's rented an Airbnb for 30 days or longer, so I'm not really sure if their platform limits the amount of time. I think the only difference is that when they go and rent, I think you could rent longer than 30 days, but you wouldn't be called a short-term rental if they rented longer than 30 days. So technically, at that point, if they started renting to people for 45 days or longer, they wouldn't even need a short-term rental license. That's a property right that everybody's entitled to. You can rent your property that you buy.
Right. Yeah. You have to get, if you're going to do under 30 days, you have to get licensed as a business. Versus if you're, and I'm speaking for Salt Lake City, just because I have.
It's the same here.
Yeah.
So if you're renting for periods of 30 days or less, then you get a short-term rental license. If you're renting for periods of 30 days or more, then you get a long-term apartment license.
There's probably a whole set of landlord-tenant rules that kick into if you're a long-term rental versus short-term. So, so I can't see any reason why we wouldn't take the chief of police recommendation and just move it to 30.
Yeah.
I think the 45 was just us, you know, came up with
trying to allow some flexibility there, yeah. I think.
We've done an over 30-day Airbnb, and they just had us check out and then check back in, theoretically. Yeah, so that was the workaround when we stayed in one for more than 30 days.
Yep, there might be.
And so, I mean,
I think campgrounds that do that too.
Yeah, like the owners are figuring that out, or Yeah.
Yeah.
But I agree that if it came from the police chief, that probably is something that just is streamlining.
Just to be consistent.
The laws and regulations.
If we ever had a challenge to it or something, we would want to be consistent. So if we're if they're renting longer than 30 days,
yeah,
then they should be being licensed under the
Dee, did you have something you wanted to say?
Apartment. Don't come up here, I might breathe on you.
That's all right.
Now
you got a mask on. Since I know where a lot of this code came from, I own three properties in Las Vegas. One of them is a short-term rental business. One of them is in North Las Vegas, one is in Las Vegas, and one is the county. The county does not have short-term rental. They're working on it, but they've been working on it for 2 years. And they don't seem, there's a lot of, well, we don't want that in our city because we're all these inns and hotels and whatever. Sherry mentioned a couple things. Generally, the law says that if it's over 30 days, that it is not a short-term rental. And so it applies to a whole different set of code for the city. So if you move that back, I'm not sure it makes any difference in me. If somebody comes in and says, I want to rent it for 6 months, that they're going to pay the short-term rental, and nobody knows any difference anyway. But if it's a short-term rental, you have to have a license. If you're going to have it less than 30 days, you cannot rent it as a short-term rental unless you have a license. And you can, let's say that you have a long-term rental and you want to rent it for 15 days, you cannot rent it to two people. You can only rent it once because it has to be rented for 30 days. So they rent it for 15 days, and then it's vacant because the law says, because it's a short-term rental, that they cannot have a short-term rental and a long-term rental situation. So these units that are being put in as short-term rental need to be regulated, that anybody that's in there has to be a short-term rental person, and if it's not a short-term rental, they cannot occupy it as a short-term rental. And so that solves the problem. Now, there was a statement made, let's let the motels and the hotels take care of this. The reason that short-term rentals are very good is that let's say you have three children and you want to go on vacation someplace, you cannot, in most cases, have all three of your children in your room with you. You can have two children, but you cannot have three. Sometimes they'll make exception. So short-term rentals make a very good sense for families who want to be together. And I know that there are cases where people, if they're not obeying the rules and not being licensed, they go around Airbnb, Vrbo, and all those guys who do the vetting. If somebody comes in and does any damage to my units, within a few days they're either fined or there's something happens, and the Airbnb or whoever has insurance that covers me. And so the idea that they're bad only happens if the landlords are bad. Because if they let anybody in, you know, they're inviting in high school senior parties or something like that, you're going to get in trouble with them, because that's the purpose of that, is to have a party. The neighbors are going to get mad, there's going to be garbage, they're going to be loud, whatever. In North Las Vegas, we are required, in fact, in both Las Vegas and North Las Vegas, we are required to have noise meters and video cameras that are mandated by the city, or each of those two cities. And so they are very highly regulated. And I know that McKenzie's looked into some of that. I don't know what she has appropriated out of those, plagiarized, but I think that, you know, short-term rentals do have a purpose, and speaking as one of those who provide those, I think that it's well to provide them, but it's also very well, as Sherry just said, we need to know where they are, we need to regulate them. If you cannot regulate them, if you don't know where they are, you cannot control them, and they become a nuisance and a problem, and you don't want that.
Thank you. Yeah, really quickly, that'd be great. Thanks.
I'm wondering if the city attorney has reviewed the legislature's requirement that doing nothing would make the short-term rentals permitted. It seems to me that that's a questionable requirement from the state. Also, we talk about licensing, we talk about enforcing, but it's been my observation that enforcing unlicensed short-term rentals is non-existent, even though they're reported. There's also, I like the idea Wendy talks about noise meters and cameras of things of that sort. You might want to consider that as a requirement. I'm wondering, we're painting with a pretty broad brush here, it seems to me, that the proposed ordinances is justified throughout the whole city. And I'm wondering if it ought not to be more restrictive with a demographic restriction or a zoning restriction, if that would meet legal standard. I think that maybe not enough study has yet been given on the issue and how it can be handled. Las Vegas, to me, is an anomaly to us in North Salt Lake. There may be some degree of mutuality in the kinds of things that go on in Las Vegas and here, but there may be more diversiveness than commonality. And so I think maybe we ought to look perhaps to other cities that have a proposed ordinance or an ordinance that are more analogous to our situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mickelson.
Chair Larson, do you mind if I comment on the enforcement end of this?
That's great.
So I think there may have been a little misunderstanding. A couple months back, I spoke to Mr. Mickelson about a neighboring fourplex that is being rented as a short-term rental, at least two of the units. And at the time, I explained, we are doing a code revision right now. And so we will put this on our list of places to investigate. I sent Rocky Crisp, our old code enforcement officer, out to take pictures and see if he could gather any evidence, even a short-term rental listing for the property. At that time, just so we had it on deck for when we adopted our new code and put standards to it, because in situations where we have an open code amendment that is going to modify whether this property is in violation or not, or the route to compliance, I didn't feel that it was appropriate to open a whole new case and start down that rabbit hole until we had it adopted, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So that's why there hasn't been a ton of movement. I did explain that. I think there may have been some miscommunication there, but we do have it on our list of properties once this code amendment goes through to investigate and get them licensed and compliant.
Thank you, Mackenzie.
And just to clarify, yes, in 2019, our city attorney did review this language. The advice that we got, as well as every other city in the state through the Utah Local League of Cities and Towns, was if you have short-term rentals and you don't want them, you need to specifically prohibit them. If you want to allow them, then you need to specifically allow them and put the standards in place in your ordinance. If your ordinance was silent, which ours was silent on whether we allowed them or didn't allow them, then that meant they were allowed and we had no conditions or no standards mm-hmm. for them at all. That's why at that time we went with, we know they exist, we would rather license them and regulate them than to try to chase down the ones and make them prohibited. That was not something that the city council wanted to entertain, was to prohibit them outright. So that is what I meant by that.
Thanks, Sherry.
So, Commissioner Jorgensen, can we advance the slide again? By the way, I do think this is instructive and helpful discussion. I appreciate everybody's comments and perspective and patience on it. I think the thought is the cat really is going to be a little, the city council will have a big decision and they're going to put the cat back in the bag and say no short-term rentals, and then that's not what's been proposed here. I do think there is, questions of enforcement, and as somebody who believes in following the rule of law, I'm all in favor of enforcing codes. That's why I get building permits for my deck that's being constructed, for my furnace replacements. It's why I try to drive the speed limit, because I believe in the rule of law. Now, I will say that, driving on the freeway, I think there's a lot of people who maybe don't, because they don't follow the speed limits. It seems like maybe it's plus or minus 15 miles an hour, whatever. But I diverge. I do think, as we think about what's been proposed in terms of the modifications, again, that's up to the city council if they want to disallow short-term rentals or something like that. And I think we need to think about, what these particular changes are and what's the right set of changes to recommend and why. And I do think the 30 days has been discussed, and I think the police chief's recommendation has some merit for consistency purposes. I don't think there's anything wrong with having penalties and enforcement mechanisms that are more specific. It's kind of like out on the freeway, it can be different grades of speeding violation, and you could get your license lost or revoked for reckless driving too fast. I think that's all well and good. The one part that I think we want to think about, and the lens that I want to apply, is housing inventory and housing shortages. And, the legislative session was just full of concerns about housing shortages and a lot being done on that. But when we think about the apartments and the 50% of units and the maximum of 10 units, does that make sense if the objective function really is to try to maximize long-term rental or long-term space rather than short-term rental house? And I ask it as a question, but I know we had a lengthy discussion about this before, and we went around and around, and that's where the 50% and max 10 units came from. But I do think it's worthy of consideration, and I think that the lens that I would want to apply is housing inventory in light of moderate income housing concerns and so forth. Do we want to liberalize, for lack of a better word, more? And I know there's some out there that are in the shadows. Again, we need to enforce, bring into compliance, all those kind of things. But I just think that point merits some further, maybe, reconsideration.
One thing, just to put it a little bit in perspective, and I don't have precise numbers. I can try to come up with some numbers if you wanted. But I do know that we have approximately 7,000 dwelling units in the city. So when I've logged into Airbnb and checked which the numbers that we have of units in this area, there's usually about, maybe 20 or so. And so really, even if you had 1%, that would be 70 units. We're not in Park City. We didn't take our code from Las Vegas because that's a party town, right? These are people who are coming to visit relatives or want to stay, maybe they're going to the temple or whatever, and they want to stay with their whole family in a one unit. So the impact is much smaller, just like the impact when we talked about ADUs. Everybody was like worried about that. What if every single family house in the city put in an ADU? Well, 100% of the residents in the city do not want to be landlords, it's less than 100% that want to be landlords. And I would wager to bet that it's probably closer to 3 or 5% want to actually have tenants in their house and have an accessory dwelling unit. Plus, it's expensive to finish an accessory dwelling unit. The trade-offs that people are weighing, whether or not they're going to have an ADU, whether they're going to have an STR, is whether that fits their personality, whether it fits their property that they want to use their property for. There are not as many people that want to use their properties for short-term rentals or ADUs as you might think.
Can I give a personal anecdote on that, Commissioner Marsh? So I have a duplex in Salt Lake that I've leased the upstairs as a long term, and then I was running the basement, attempting to run the basement fully furnished as a short term, and at the price that I was trying to list at, and for having it for as, you know, big of a pain as it was going to be, I didn't want to hire a management company. I didn't want to have to deal with all that. And so at the end of the day, instead of leasing that as a short term rental, I've leased it as a long term rental and start out at like a 3 month, with most people then switching to month. And so it's a, you know, 6 months to at most a year rental. And that's just sort of an example where, because I couldn't get the market rate and the amount of effort that it was going to take to make that a short-term rental and to make money off of it, I didn't do it. I kept it as a long-term rental. So I think that's also good, especially for apartments and for you know, duplexes, threeplexes, fourplexes, and so on. You're going, like, that market rate still exists, and it's hard to hit those numbers in a lot of cases.
I would like to make a point as well. So our short-term rental code for single-family dwellings and two-family dwellings still require owner occupancy at least half of the year. So, in theory, this gives those homeowners or property owners a route to make supplemental income the way you might with in just standard ADU or that type of thing, and rent their property as a short-term rental when they leave for the winter and go to their winter house in Arizona. Or maybe they already have an ADU and it makes more financial sense for them to rent their basement apartment as a short-term rental than a long-term lease. It just gives them that extra opportunity to supplement their income and pay for the extraordinary housing prices that we're dealing with right now. So just wanted to remind you of that point. I can't speak to that fact with multifamily, though. I just know that's the case, and that's the intent of our owner occupancy requirements in single family and two family units.
Thank you. Any other input or comments, discussion on the housing impact?
So to share, Commissioner Marsh, the one place that we know of then that's doing this is the old hostel, brothel. Is there any other known places that would even get close to the max 10 units?
Village Station would be the biggest one. The building number 2, I think they have, I want to say 6 or 8, I'm not sure off the top of my head, out of 70 units.
And those are individually purchased units that then the owner?
No, the same people that own the apartments, okay. They just rent those particular units that are ground floor units.
Yeah, I was unfamiliar, so that's why I was asking.
They're just ground floor units that they rent as short-term rentals.
As a reminder, just because you might not know its name, Village Station are the apartments down by the stop gas station on Highway 89.
The newer ones.
They're the southernmost end.
Do you have any idea what the occupancy rate of the apartments are? They 100% rented out?
Oh yeah, they're all rented out. They have no problem with keeping very, very low vacancy rates in the apartments. From every indication that I've gotten from landlords that I've talked to in this area. So even though some of those places are so expensive, it's crazy.
Any other thoughts or input?
I'd concur with the 30-day and just would send that as a recommendation if, you know, we're going to make a motion on it. I think it's wise to match it with state code.
And for me, focusing on the 50% of units with the max 10, I can't come up with a better number. I agree that there should be a limit. To me, that seems pretty right.
Where you're still keeping 50% as long term?
Yeah. Well, only 50% can be short term, and you can only have 10. So I know the demand isn't there now, but who knows what the market does? If a developer came in and wanted to build a 100-unit short term rental apartment, that would restrict them from doing that.
Right.
Agreed with Commissioner Ward. The 50% weighed heavier for me, thinking of duplexes and fourplexes. And then the 10, we just needed to throw something there to cap it for the extreme scenario. But it was really more focused on those people that do have a duplex to fourplex. The 50% really seemed to apply.
And certainly, if through experience and as we implement this code, if we ran into problems, we would bring a code amendment back to you to consider.
To answer my own question, based on what I'm hearing, and please correct me if I'm hearing wrong, I am getting old. But given the fact that we really don't have that much housing inventory that would fall into this category, the allowance for short-term rentals is relatively small as a percentage of the total housing inventory in North Salt Lake. Is that a fair
yes,
takeaway
that is
for,
very fair
to answer my own concern?
Yeah.
Okay.
Commissioner Marsh, last question. Well, for me, I don't have. I'm not going to speak for everybody else. The last thing that I want to mention about the licensing. So, for example, when somebody comes up with a building permit and it's obvious that there's already a rental going on, does the city require them to then get licensed as a landlord? And I know this has happened to me personally in other cities where, like Salt Lake City, once you list it as a rental, they're on you. They say, hey, you need to go get your good landlord training. You need to get licensed. This just happened to me because I was pulling a building permit for a place up in Roy. Roy City came to me, said, you need to have good landlord training. You need to get licensed. One, does the city currently do that for long-term rentals? And two, would there be a mechanism for us to do this for short-term rentals to kind of alleviate some of the licensing concerns where we're not really going to throw sticks necessarily, but is there a way to say, hey, you're now on our radar, go get licensed?
Yeah. So when we find something when something comes up on our radar, whether it's from a building permit or it could be from submittal of taxes, like sometimes we get the sales tax, the transient room tax, and it attributes it to a specific address. And so we're like, okay, well, what business are they doing at this address? It's a single family house. So the change to state code just this time is that we can now use the advertisement on Airbnb or on these platforms as one of the tools. One, we cannot be the only piece of evidence, but there are other pieces of evidence that we could obtain. That makes it a little easier. So yes, when people come in and we find out that they have, for whatever reasons, then now they're on our radar and we tell them they need to get licensed. Absolutely.
So you would now, if this were to then get passed, you'd now have the ability, based on both the listing and room tax, plus whatever evidence, that you could then go to the owner, whoever the owner of record is, and say, you now need to get this licensed as a short-term rental.
And as far as long-term rentals go, we do not require business owners to be a good landlord. We encourage that, and in the way that we encourage that is with a carrot, and we reduce the licensing rate drastically.
Which is similar to what Salt Lake and Roy and other places are doing.
So if you don't want to be a good landlord, then you can be a bad landlord if
you'd
like.
And I do have two property owners that are not wanting to be good landlords, and so they pay the full price, which is fine. I want to point out that we do not require every single long-term leaser of a single-family home or whatever it is to get a business license. They are only prompted and required to get a business license by our code when they are renting four or more units in the city. That's when it triggers them. So if I start to see a single property owner doing a bunch of building permits, we have a guy that owns, I feel like, half of the Main Street neighborhood at this point, he has to have a business license. But if I just own a home and I move to another home, but I keep that for a rental, I don't need one. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
And like we noticed in COVID that a lot of there were corporations that were buying up houses in Foxborough. So American Homes for Rent, they own like 70 houses out there that they're long-term rentals, but that's how we found them, was by, we're clicking on properties and we're like, who is this? What there seems like there's a lot of these ones. And then we discovered them and reached out to them and said, hey, you're operating, you need a business license.
And I have one more thing to comment on, because I thought you brought a good point up. The other thing that we are very diligent with is when we're reviewing building permits that have to do with basement remodels or additions or those types of things, we look specifically if they're adding a second kitchen. And if they are, we go, hey, are you doing an accessory dwelling unit? You need a free permit. Or, hey, if you're not, we need you to sign this affidavit saying you're not doing an ADU, and we record it at the county. So we try to catch those things, but we also try to be really nice about it. So.
Commissioner Marsh?
Any other comments on that?
Just want to thank Sherry. I know you got a lot going on, and I think that was very helpful to, you know, walk us down memory lane on that and then have that discussion about what these changes would and would not do. So thank you for the effort.
You're welcome.
Agreed. And thank you, Commissioner Jorgensen, for asking for that to give us that zoom out of how we got here and then projecting what we want to have it look like in the future. That was very helpful. All right, Sherry, do you want to review any of these chapters specifically, or do you want us to move into a motion discussion?
I haven't changed anything since the last meeting, so unless you found some errors in there that I need to correct.
Okay. Let's just go through.
Or concerns that you have.
Each chapter, chapter 10. Any comment on that?
Title 10, chapter 11. Well, this is actually going to go, if you make a motion to recommend this, it's going to go to the City Council next week to be introduced to the City Council, and then they won't take action on it until April 1st. Give them 2 weeks to read it and digest it. 3 weeks, actually, by the time they get their packet.
Okay.
Can I ask a point of clarification on the process, too? So I think it's notable that we've had, for example, Mr. Mickelson's letter, you know,
that going to
feedback,
the file as
so,
part of the record.
That would make its way to the City Council just in due course?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
I know I'm out of order, but I got another question.
Is it a quick one?
You can just tell us from there.
Yeah. How do you handle a conflict between the subdivision CC&Rs and the proposed cause? And also, I'd like to see if they could still be changes made to have the cameras and the noise monitors required.
Those, I don't want to speak for the staff, but it sounds like those ideas have been brought up and looked into for our specific city and uses, and come to the conclusion that at this point it's not a problem. But if it were to become a problem that we were having noise issues or camera issues, that, like Sherry said, that they would come through with a code amendment to add that into the code. But since we are a different type of city than Las Vegas, that currently is not a pressing need or something that we would want to impact landowners with additional things that are not seen as necessary for our specific area. If staff wants to make a comment on that.
That sums that up pretty well. And then as far as the, what was the first?
CC&Rs.
The city does not enforce HOA rules. All that we ask is if they are in an HOA that they give a letter from their HOA that says that this is a permitted in their city, in their use.
And as part of their application, their land use permit, they have to sign an affidavit saying that they have reviewed their CC&Rs, if any, and the short-term rental does not conflict. So they have to
acknowledge that,
sign and have it notarized, yeah. Even that
so
they've reviewed it.
We've had a complaint come in on a Airbnb in the Ridge, and their CC&R specifically prohibit short-term rentals in their development. So that was a reason that we could not give that person a short-term rental license. But HOA rules can change all the time. Like, it's just that matter of that HOA meeting and voting to change it, and I would never know about it, the city. So for me, I don't really care what the HOA rules are. Mm-hmm. I don't enforce the HOA rules. They have them because they've all agreed to live by those rules, and they've all signed documents that say they'll live by those rules. The HOA has to enforce their own rules as well. So if somebody came in today and said, my HOA allows it, but then 6 months from now, the HOA changes their mind and they amend their rules to prohibit them, I would never get notification of that we needed to do anything. Also, they'd be grandfathered in, but if the HOA wanted to take action against them, that would be up to them, not us. We wouldn't enforce it.
Right.
Who enforces the CC&R violations?
The HOA enforces their own CC&R violations. The city does not invoice, enforce private covenants.
Yeah, city enforces city code.
That's right. It has to be CC&R. In a city code because
it's
that's...
It's a private entity, not yeah. a city entity.
The city can only enforce the rules that they adopt. We cannot enforce the rules that a private entity adopts.
Which is code. Also why we want to adopt some rules about short-term rentals.
Yes.
Yes. All right, Sherry, do you want us to go through the review here, like the amusement centers? Do we want to allow this? Do you want us to go down this list and discuss this? How can we be most helpful?
If there are ones that you want to, that you've highlighted, I think that would be appropriate. But I think we touched on everything last time.
Okay.
As far as I know, we got the answers unless you have, unless something's come up in your reading.
All right, so let's just go down this review list. Touch on each one just to make sure that we've gone over each of these so that this can be ready to go to the city council. So amusement centers, do we want to allow in the CS zone with size restrictions? Where did we land on that?
What was the specific use?
I think that we were thinking of something like an escape room
or axe throwing
that would just need a smaller space.
So it's max size restriction, and
yes.
we float like 5,000 square feet or 10,000? What was the...
Yeah, see, that was the one I forgot to write down. I don't have it on this copy.
It's probably 10,000?
So just to put it in perspective, like the Ace Hardware is 10,000 square feet. The... Yeah, or in one of the, like a strip mall, usually one section of them is about 1,500 to 2,000 square feet.
Sherry, we're trying to keep you from not talking.
Does anybody have input between 5 and 10,000? 10,000 is ACE, and 5,000 is what, FIZ? Oh, thank you. Sorry, I didn't hear that.
I'll actually show you an example of...
I suppose I should unmute myself. Okay, so an example of this could be up here by Wendy's, which is now a car dealership. Ugh. You said it, not me. So this building right here, I had a company called Bay Indoor Golf who does golf simulators want to come in. And they would have been classified under this land use. They wanted to make it kind of a small Top Golf, but with golf simulators. And they are, this is about 2,315 square feet, so 2,300. Let me see.
Show like a unit in a strip mall. Like
well, let me there. Go over by Weiniger's, because that's the other CS zone that I think you might run into. Some sort of neighborhood entertainment.
Sorry.
Just based on that, 5,000 seems plenty.
Mm-hmm. I agree. 5,000 seems generous.
Yeah. So it's hard to see what a unit would look like because this is a single ownership, but I can anticipate based off the roof. Maybe I'll do this because we'll pretend it's two units.
That's probably two units there.
Yeah, see, that's probably two units, and it's 2,500. So 5,000 is quite generous.
Does anyone feel like we should go less than 5,000, or do we feel okay with 5,000?
I think 5 is great.
5,000, if someone came in and did a tenant improvement on this entire half of the building, it'd be about 6,000. So I think 5,000 is a nice spot to stay, and if someone came in wanting to do that, they can ask for a code amendment.
All right. Sounds good. Any additional comment? Everyone? Okay. And then general office, do we want to allow in the CS with size restriction?
That's right.
General office, are we thinking like H&R Block or we're thinking?
Yeah. So in that, I'd probably
so
go down.
So general office that is public is accessing?
Yes. Sorry, my brain went to pot last week.
That's okay. Any input?
Service.
In the CS zone?
I didn't understand a max restriction myself.
I can comment on this. So there was some confusion back then when we first came across, I guess not confusion, when we first were looking at general office in the CS zone, and you guys said, hey, we don't want that there. We want the CS zone to be retail focus and personal service focus and that kind of thing.
Neighborhood services.
Neighborhood services, yes. Mm-hmm. We got looking through our land use table, and there's H&R Blocks mm-hmm. and a lawyer's office and those types of services that I would argue are still important to the neighborhood, lower impact, and don't require typically as large of an office. Mm-hmm. And Commissioner Jorgensen, I believe, brought up this facility that's over by Wendy's as well in the CS zone. It's about 10,000 square feet, what? And it's a multi-tenant office building, but okay. that's the only one we have in the CS zone. The rest of it is more strip mall office mm-hmm. space where we're going to run into that same size that we just talked about and that same strip mall.
And this particular one is actually, I believe, 3 stories tall, so it's really a 30,000 square foot building.
All right, so let's just start initially with, do we want to allow it in the CS at all?
We have so little CS to begin with, I don't think it makes a big difference.
Okay.
I think, yeah, with a 5,000 square foot max seems appropriate.
Okay.
Well, are we then saying that that building could not be used for general office?
No.
That's a grandfathered building. It can continue to be used.
But I'm saying if the use changed.
Just like South.
Yeah.
If it changes from a therapist to an H&R Block, it's still general office. If it changes from...
Right, but I'm just saying if that use ever changes away from that to something else and then wants to go back, if we cap it, it could not... We are regulating that out of existence if it changes. Do we want to do that for that building? Because that's like the only building.
It's a really nice building.
That was my point on the max. I just didn't understand the max.
And that's what I'm saying. If we're going to allow it, let's just allow it and not put a max in.
From a staff perspective, I think that's great.
Yeah.
Just because the types of offices that we're looking at here are not your call center. They are the lawyer's office and that kind of thing.
Any opposition to that from commission?
Yeah, I oppose for the same reason that if it did change and was unregulated, that whole building could be a call center.
Well, we regulate call centers in a different area, okay. don't
well,
we? They're not under general
not
office.
Necessarily happy with.
Sure.
So in that building, how many places you say are there? 3?
There's 3 stories, and there's numerous units inside. I have no idea how many businesses
and then,
are in there
right
now.
But a square footage, a max of square footage would limit one business, not
right.
the entire building.
And a thing to note
right?
here is, like, for example, open book over here, my therapist is in that building, right? And they just occupy a little suite that's probably 1,000 square feet.
So I kind of agree with Brandon. Like, I would like to have a max square footage just because I don't see the need for, if it's public serving, like an H&R Block, like a, I understand that there's like limited space, but I also feel like why not just cover the bases while we're at it?
Well,
and like,
but what if Chevron moved their offices from the refinery to that building and it was all Chevron? Why would we care?
I think we would care because
that's
we're
not
trying to say
reasons.
That
that's
office
not public
building that we would
anymore.
Want to have come in would have either. Some kind of community flow to it. So like a therapist or an H&R Block or an attorney or something where it isn't just a commute in and out.
If we're doing it in CS where we want it to be neighborhood services, then I would be opposed to Chevron going in and putting all their offices in there because what is the public using that for? Nothing. It's their employees, right? So, to me, I think a max on the square footage is not a bad idea.
So, if you limited it to 5,000 square feet, then in that building, they could have 2 tenants a max.
I think that's even too big.
The lowest amount of tenants on a floor would be 2. They'd have to have 2 or more, basically, per floor.
Yeah, and I even think 5,000 is very generous.
I want to point out one more thing, that when we're looking at the commercial zones and things like that, these office buildings, while we would rather see a boutique or a restaurant or whatever, these office buildings are bringing daytime population to these areas that will support those uses. So I think they're important to have in these zones. It's just how big do we want to allow them?
That's a good point.
So the current use is like, is it Prudential? Like what is being used there?
Coldwell Banker, I think.
There at this building that we were just looking at?
Or Realty Coldwell.
There's a Berkshire Hathaway, my therapist, another company. I don't know. When I go in there, my therapist is on the main floor, and then there's another unit that has some sort of professional office. I don't know what they do, but it's a smaller outlet, and then there's multiple stories above.
So if H&R Block came and said, we want the whole floor or half the floor, and we put a size limit in, we have now said, H&R Block, you are not allowed to use.
If they called me and said they wanted to do that, I would encourage them to apply for a code amendment and say, hey, this actually doesn't make sense for this situation, and request that we
So why modify. Would we put it in now if they would apply and then you would change it?
So we have more control of the Chevron coming in and
building a new building, let's say up here at Orchard.
Or like I said, Chevron offices coming in and saying, we want to take this entire floor or whatever that looks like. I would probably not encourage them based on this conversation to apply for a code amendment the way that I would a neighborhood service. Have faith in staff.
And just as by way of history on that particular building, since we're talking about it, it was built by a gentleman named Todd Cusick. He's the same one who funded the AstroTurf field at Woods Cross High School. Anyway, he was in a variety of businesses. And one of the businesses was Wasatch Energy, and I think one of the primary tenants on the third floor was Wasatch Energy. They were energy traders. Anyway, so we originally that's what it was a more industrial type office type use energy trading, and they occupied the entire floor.
Okay, so if we were to put 5,000 as the size restriction, where are we at a straw poll there? Is it?
I'd be fine with that.
Start with Holbrook.
Not a hill for me to die on, but I don't get it.
So you're saying no size restriction?
Yeah.
Okay.
I would say yes on if that's, I would agree with that.
On five?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes on five?
I'd say no restriction.
No restriction. Marsh?
We get to decide.
I would say no restriction.
No restrictions. Again, I think we'll be fine without it.
So that's three no restrictions.
Four.
Four no restrictions.
All right.
Okay.
Good work. Yeah.
You don't get a vote?
Not unless it's a tie.
I'm leaving. I'm just kidding.
Can I change my vote just to see how you vote?
and then change it back.
Ooh, I like this.
You should have been thinking that.
Getting spicy.
All right. So specific use standards.
I think, we talked about the community and urban gardens and not having a restriction on the size on residential zones. I remember that from last time.
Should there be a minimum lot for lot size for community gardens in residential zones? We were leaning towards no. Is that still settling well? Anyone opposed to that? Okay. Line 677, food service contractors, should we limit these to 3,000 square feet?
I think last time the consensus was no limit. I remember correctly.
That we should not limit them?
Yeah.
Does anyone feel strongly in favor of limiting them to 3,000 square feet? Mackenzie, do you have input? Okay. Just taking it all in. All right. Anybody feel strongly about a limit, or can we leave that without a restriction? All right. Looks like leaving it without a restriction is sitting okay. Line 710, food trucks with drive-up windows.
I don't remember what the consensus was.
I think we should not allow, as long as we're not restricting what, kind of what we talked about before with like the Sips or the Java Joes or the little ones that aren't really a food truck but could potentially be moved. So as long as, you know, because I think those are covered under like a drive-through restaurant or coffee shop type model. They have to have a certain amount of car.
They don't leave the site every day.
But if you had a food truck in a random parking lot and now you have a drive-through window, it just is chaos.
That's weird.
Yeah, or if you try and get one of the food trucks at the park to set up for a drive-through window, that's going to be problematic. Yeah. So
not
looks
allowed.
Like we're leaning towards not allowed.
I don't know. Does anybody else feel differently?
I'm the contrarian tonight, but yeah, I don't have a problem with him at all. I think just like similar to short-term rental perception, the food truck service the quality has gone up. I don't think that there should be thought of as these dives that are secondhand anymore. I think that there's value in having it.
Yeah, I interpret that more to be that there is not the space regulation to have six cars waiting in the line at the food truck. So not that the food truck quality is low, but that unless the food truck is parked in a location that can have a lineup, it creates problematic spatial.
I agree with that, but the city can regulate the public space, and property owners should have the wherewithal to evaluate that when they're allowing the use for the food truck too.
Tell that to Chick-fil-A.
Should be on them.
Yeah, when they bring in their temporary.
Yeah,
they did have a drive-through window traffic on that flow everywhere thing during COVID.
Well, it's an example if you're going to have a drive-up where I think. It depends on the details, so that comes back to why conditional use permits were so prevalent, because a lot of times it just depends, right? So some locations, totally benign, no problem, no handle a queue, whatever, but others might be tight and congested, and it just becomes a public nuisance. So anyway, I still have concerns if we allow it.
All right, so we have one not allowed. Is everyone else leaning towards allowed?
Are we saying allowing a drive-through for a food truck? Is that what we're talking about?
That the food truck could have a drive-through window.
Picture when Chick-fil-A was down at the Family Dollar store when it was closed during COVID. It had a drive-through.
It's not that you can't have a drive-through window on your food truck. It's that you can't set it up and have cars drive through and be serviced at your food truck.
You can have a walk-up window.
So the model is you go to a parking lot, park, or you walk and get, walk to your food truck, get your food, hang out. It's that you can't take your car right next to the food truck, drive, be serviced by the food truck. That is what the question is. Not whether or not the food truck can or cannot have that window. It's can that window be used by cars in a drive-through model?
Picture the taco place at the oil lube place on 89. Like, do we want them to have the ability for cars to come through and buy food?
I think what Brandon's saying has the point, right? Of like whoever property they're on is the one able to regulate whether or not that's possible, right?
Because until it starts interfering with traffic because it spills out because they didn't do it right, and now you're blocking the public right away. And
when their drive-through goes all the way around to Redwood, and that is a standing, but the drive-through there does not have enough space, and
which
it often.
One?
At Beto's on Redwood.
Oh. Wow.
That drive-through often comes out all the way and then goes into the emergency lane on Redwood.
Well, I didn't know they were that popular.
Oh, often.
Or Nielsen spilling out on the 26th, then blocking the lane on 26.
It does the same thing, but because the emergency lane is the width of a car there, it isn't causing traffic flow problems, just tightness, but it happens not infrequently that drive-through goes all the way back out onto Redwood.
So for permanent drive-through locations, we do have stacking requirements.
Yeah. So I just see that seling your food, I don't think you care what the traffic impact is because you're going to pack up and leave in 4 hours anyway. So I feel like if I was owning the food cart, I wouldn't necessarily feel like it would be like, yeah, it's problematic for 3 hours and then we're going to leave. But
could we reference the same drive-through standards of a fixed building?
If they're going to have drive-through, then they have to have meet the same stacking stand or same drive-through standards as a fixed restaurant.
I would be fine with that. Otherwise, I'm just a no.
Okay. How does everyone feel about having the same standards of a drive-through apply to food trucks? Anybody opposed to that?
Not opposed to it.
I'm not opposed to it. But do you require lines?
No. Space.
No, but they have plans. That was exactly when Chick-fil-A came in and wanted to do that temporarily. They were on a parcel that had a business that had gone out of business. And they had to show us a plan of how they were going to manage the drive-through traffic, especially because they were adjacent to and a daycare that had the same egress that the daycare parents had to get through the traffic line to get to the daycare.
I couldn't remember.
You remember that now? Apparently not enough people like Chick-fil-A in North Salt Lake, so they didn't come. May build a permanent restaurant.
I think the stacking could be a problem. I'd even go so far as to say is it probably is in most cases, but not all cases. And that's what we're doing if we prohibit it completely. And I think that there are bad examples all over the place. But I think it's unfair to say that it's always going to be a problem.
Yeah, the taco cart in the service could do it. The food trucks on the Monday nights can't. And if we impose a stacking regulation, wouldn't that
would fix that.
That would fix it. So yeah,
as long as the wherever they were parking, they had room for stacking.
The right language to regulate.
Right, and then how does this? I mean, it's like a temporary stacking.
They could put cones out.
Cones out with.
Yeah. Okay. And employees that directed traffic and take the order because they're not going to put up a menu.
As long as there is a reasonable stacking standard that is easy for them to follow, that is straightforward, that is going to prevent that, I don't have a problem.
But I also feel like this is another case where it's like very small percentage of food trucks are even
We may never have one do this.
Like that was one example 5 years ago, but like I rarely see food trucks with the drive up.
Has it been 5 years? Yes.
5 years today.
But
time flies.
Rudy Gobert tested
us. Oh my gosh, that was today. Oh my gosh, on the dot.
Rudy Gobert caused all of this.
ESPN did a huge
and look, today. Sherry's still wearing a mask for good reason.
Yeah, so my vote would be if we had like the same whatever regulations as
okay,
the norm.
So but I also don't think it's going to be that impactful. Allow food trucks to have drive-ups with the language of our drive-through code applied.
Yes.
Everyone good with
which
that?
Which is 4D?
Which is there's a I'll just reference the section because it's in there.
Okay.
I've got a specific section for drive-thrus. Okay, prohibited signs. Are there any other signs that you want to prohibit? Here's your sign.
You're the expert. Is there anything else we should?
I think I got them all.
Okay.
Everyone good
but
with that?
People invent new stuff all the time.
No new signs. Nothing new and creative.
Do not get creative in this city.
All right. And then
here's your sign. Are you calling us all stupid?
Hmm? Oh my gosh.
And,
yeah. All right. And then free speech zone.
Any concerns on that?
Allowing it everywhere or what?
No. So if we're having public events, the mayor can designate an area where people could protest or
without interfering with the event.
Without interfering with the event and harassing the people who are coming to their event. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's some of the problems that we've had is a particular
the balloon festival
person coming to the mm-hmm. one of our weekly events that and just putting out their flags all the way up the sidewalk in front of the other vendors. And we would designate a spot for them to do that. They couldn't just do
it. I think
it
that's very helpful park. Because I think we have received a lot of public comment via phone calls of that is negatively impacting
the
experience in the city. And so having a way to regulate that, which we have not had at this point.
Correct.
Fantastic.
And is that only then for city-sponsored events?
Any event, if it's on public property.
Okay.
If it's on private property, we can't regulate it.
And I'm sure there's free speech. I'm sure they're taking example from Salt Lake City or other cities that already have ordinances.
Surprisingly, there aren't a whole lot of ordinances on this. I found Taylorsville's, and there's one for the state of Utah for the Capitol in their rulemaking. Those are the two best examples I could find.
Salt Lake City doesn't have one?
I couldn't find it, but their code is really hard to figure out.
Oh. Okay.
Well, lucky us to have agitation to make this happen, because we probably wouldn't be doing it if we didn't have agitation.
Yeah.
Okay, any other comments on that? Or comment or discussion in general on this modification? And if not, we can move towards a motion.
Commissioner Jorgensen, so just as a matter of procedure, we've captured a number of recommendations on just some further refinements. The first one we talked about was short-term rentals. So I'm assuming when we make the motion, we can just incorporate by reference the cumulative body of all of those individual captures we just went through without having to list them.
Yep.
Because that'll make it easier to offer the motion.
Yes. Yes, I think that would work. That should work, right, Sherry?
Yes.
If in the motion we just reference the line item,
the edits as discussed, as per this discussion.
Great. You kept track of all of them, then you should make the motion.
By all means. Are we ready for a motion?
We're ready.
All right, Commissioner Jorgensen. I move the Planning Commission recommend to the City Council approval of the proposed code amendments subject to the discussion and Planning Commission tonight and the recommended revisions with the following findings. One, the proposed amendment is in accord with the comprehensive general plan goals and policies of the city. Two, changed or changing conditions make the proposed amendment reasonably necessary to carry out the purposes stated in this title.
Thank you, Commissioner Jorgensen. Do we have a second?
Commissioner Holbrook, second.
Thank you. And then any comment or discussion on the motion?
Again, I just think it's important that this letter be entered into the record so the City Council can see the dissenting views. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I will include it.
What?
I'll include the letter.
Okay. And then just the comment of thank you for everybody's patience as we talked all this through that we worked through a lot of things there, then it settles really well as it is written. So thank you for everyone's patience and work on this. Any other comments on the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? And it passes. Good job, Sherry. Good job, Mackenzie. Good job, staff everywhere.
Sherry and Mackenzie.
That was a big bite. All right, and then the report on City Council items.
My report is I was sick last week and didn't go to City Council. But I know that they had a public hearing on the train horns.
I watched the public hearing. It was very intense. We had one whole citizen comment. And he's in this room. Didn't you comment? Yeah, yeah. So the turnout was spectacular and nothing else happened.
Fantastic.
Would you like me to review it for you?
We'll wait for the cliff notes to come.
All right, and then we will move to the approval of the minutes. Any adjustments to the minutes? And if not, we can do a motion to approve them.
I already used my one motion up. But I can do it again. Does Commissioner Jorgensen make a motion to approve the meeting minutes for the February 25th, 2025 Planning Commission meeting as drafted?
Thank you, Commissioner Jorgensen. And a second?
I'll second it.
Thank you, Commissioner Ward. And all in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. And then just I will be gone on the March 25th meeting.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Yeah. So me and Commissioner Tucker will be gone on March 25th.
We're going to the same place.
We're both going to Italy. Yes. Scandal.
I thought you were making a heart with your hands right there. Your hands are like this, and I was like, together. I was like, that's awesome. Don't do that.
You're not very sneaky.
I need four people in the forum.
Okay, and I think I didn't say that the meeting's passed, and then we're adjourned. Thank you, thank you.